Stand and pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and unto ages of ages. Amen. Okay, tonight we are going to talk about graven images. Graven images. What do you think of when you hear graven images? Graven images. You've heard the term before or no? No? All right, how about this? Father, what do you think of when you hear graven images? The words graven images.
Statues and stuff.
All right, statues and stuff. Okay. Have you ever been, Christina, have you ever been to a Protestant church and noticed that there are... not a whole lot of religious images there?
I never went to a Protestant church.
You've never been to a Protestant church? Oh.
Yeah,
Anna? You have?
Yes.
What kind? Do you remember what it was?
There's no statues.
There were no statues.
Just
a cross. Was there anything on the cross or any images, pictures? Anything on the walls, icons or anything like that? No images, huh? No images. So, that's a very common experience when you walk into a typical American Protestant church to find that it is devoid of religious imagery. Devoid of religious imagery. Why is that? Well, it goes back to the Reformation and a bit before that. So what is a graven image? Where do we get this phrase, graven images? Christina's never even heard the phrase, graven images. I never heard this. What is this? Well, the phrase comes from a common translation of Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. So why don't we go there and take a look at that? That's Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. This is the first of a few occurrences of the Ten Commandments in the Old Testament. This is the first listing of them. Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. Everyone there? All right, Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. So the three realms of existence for the ancient Hebrew, right? The sky, the land, and the water. So you're not going to make a graven image of anything that's in the sky, the land, or the water, right? So it'd be the sun, the moon, the stars, birds, right in the sky. On the earth, on the land, any land animals or trees or fruit or all that. And then in the water, well, the various types of fish and swimming things, right? The various types of swimming things. Okay, so this is Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness or anything that is in the heaven above, or there's the earth beneath, or there's the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. So, what do you think about that? Do you have any images in your house of anything that's in the sky or on the land or in the sea? Do you have maybe a picture of a dolphin? Maybe a statue of a dolphin? A lot of people have something like that. And it's very pretty. Or maybe something like this. Huh? Look at that. Is that not an image? Is this not a graven image? Look at that. There's an icon. on right there. Father Anthony, you should be ashamed having these types of things in this building. Here's another one. The place is filled with them everywhere I'm looking. Right? You go over to the Roman Catholic Church down the street. It's going to be filled with statues of angels and various people. Right? But look what it says right here. It says, you shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above and the earth beneath. What about that? In fact, I've got a little newspaper clipping here in my Bible. I stuck it in here because it was relevant to the topic. Let me read this to you. This is a little clipping from a newspaper. Pittsburgh. An Amish man who visited his ailing father in Canada has not been allowed to return because of border security aimed at thwarting terrorists. The man, adhering to the Bible's prohibition of graven images, has no photo identification. He's surely a land animal, right? So you can't have an image of himself. According to officials in Licking Township, Pennsylvania, midway between Pittsburgh and New York border, U.S. officials told the man photo waivers, once granted the Amish, have been cut off because of the security concerns. The man's wife and children remain in the United States. Do you have a photograph of your son in your house?
On my phone.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't think about that. Think about phones nowadays, right? Look at all the graven images. I don't even know if you can qualify that with a graven image. It's digital. I mean, it doesn't even have existence. What is it? People have images all over the place. Pictures, statues, carvings. I remember I had a seven-day Adventist in my house one time, and this topic came up. And I had a clock on the wall that had some pretty little grapevines on it. And I said, what about that? And he said, well, never thought about that. I said, well, grapevines are on the land, right? It's anything in the sky, anything on the land, anything in the sea. Grapevines, those are on the land. He said, that's right. I said, so is that condemned? He said, I think it is. So I took it off the wall, and I set it there on the table. And I walked around, I looked. One of my kids' stuffed animals was there. I grabbed the stuffed animal. I said, what about this thing? Well, I never really thought about it. I suppose that'd be condemned too. As a stuffed animal, it's a little teddy bear. A bear's a land animal. Isn't this? It's created by hand. And so you can see how far this can go. You will have some people who will actually be afraid to have any kind of imagery whatsoever, like the Amish, all the way to a photograph of themselves. But most Protestants, as they read this text, don't take it that far. Because look what it says. It says in verse 5, you shall not bow down to them or serve them. So many Protestants will read the text here and say, no. This is not a condemnation of artwork. This is a condemnation of religious artwork. Artwork that you might have in your church. Okay? So at least it kind of narrows it down a bit, the scope, right? So then I ask you, I mean, isn't that condemned then by this? Isn't that icon there on the wall condemned? You've got, look at that, there's a cross with some, and I'm sure you have paintings in your house. What if you have a religious painting? What if you have an icon? What if you have a statue? Are these things condemned? This is why when you walk into a typical American Protestant church, I say this because American Protestantism is different from European Protestantism, you'll typically find in American Protestant churches that they are devoid of imagery. White walls. If there's a cross, and that's not always going to be there, but if you find a cross somewhere up at the front, rarely you're going to see anything on it. Right? Why? Because the Bible says. See what it says right there? It's the Ten Commandments. Don't you keep the Ten Commandments? So what's going on here? What's happening? Well, traditionally, the church, East and West, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Ethiopian, Catholic, Coptic, Armenian, Roman Catholic, Melkite. Historically, the apostolic churches have always understood this to be a condemnation of idolatry. Of idolatry. Not a condemnation of making artwork in general, nor a condemnation of making religious artwork. But rather a condemnation of idolatry, of making an idol of a pagan god. That is how it has traditionally been interpreted in the church in the last 2,000 years. And that's why up until the Reformation, for the most part, you do not find these buildings devoid of religious imagery. In fact, it's the opposite. You find piles and layers of images, right? Think of the, in the West, the period, the Rococo period, right? So, what's correct? What is the proper interpretation of the text? Now, if you've been to a lot of Protestant churches, you might find, especially if you were in some in Europe, or more traditional Protestant churches here in the United States, if you could use the word traditional in that case, say a Missouri Synod Lutheran church or a High Anglican church, you might find a statue. You might find some icons. So, why the difference? Well, it has to do with the history of Protestantism. Protestantism has three major founders: Luther, Calvin, and Zwingli. Right? And it kind of goes, it degrades as you go along. Okay, so Luther, well, you know, it was, if you look at what Luther taught, what he did, and things like that, you find that it's just a slight shade off from what was being taught in the Roman Catholic Church at the time. Certainly different, certainly heresy, but it's not too far. Okay, if you go into a traditional Lutheran church, in fact, I know a Roman Catholic who went and attended a traditional Missouri Synod Lutheran church. He came out and he said, that was the most Catholic service I've ever been to. Right? They were singing in Gregorian chant and swinging incense. They were kneeling at the communion rail, all sorts of stuff like that. So, but that's not the typical experience of most people as they walk into a Protestant church. American Protestantism is influenced at its root by Martin Luther, because it's part, they're part of the Reformation tradition. But in more ways than one, they're influenced by Calvin and Zwingli. That the iconoclasm, the whitewashed walls, that's Calvin. Luther was not an iconoclast. He condemned the idea of destroying, getting rid of the religious imagery that happened as the Reformation spread throughout Europe and was turning these churches into Protestant churches and cleansing them of imagery. Luther condemned the practice of cleansing them of religious imagery. Calvin encouraged it. Okay. So why is the difference? Well, it has to do with how they read Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. If you look at Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, Luther looked at this and he said, well, this is a condemnation of idolatry. This isn't a condemnation of religious imagery. Luther was a fairly well-educated individual. Calvin, fairly well-educated as well. However, as Calvin read this, he said, no, 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 this is a condemnation of religious imagery in general. And so, hence the whitewashed walls of your typical Protestant church here in America, coming from that Calvinistic tradition. So, which one is right? The traditional view, understanding and read of this text that you find in all the apostolic churches, Roman Catholic, Greek Orthodox, Melkite, whatever, you, anything. Or, and also, by the way, Luther. Or Calvin. Is it a condemnation of religious imagery? Or is it a condemnation of a particular type of religious imagery? That is, pagan religious imagery. Idolatry. The making of an image of a false god that you're going to fall down and worship, right? Which one is it? Well, remember, Context is everything, right? Context is everything. When you're reading a text, if someone ever quotes you some text from the Bible out of context, then you know you've got a problem, right? Always, when someone quotes you a text out of the Bible and they're not reading the whole context, you're going to find a problem. Because every text has to have a context. Otherwise, it doesn't mean anything. I can take all sorts of little phrases out of things that you've said, someone has said to me, something I said, and make it mean the exact opposite. I was listening to a Protestant minister who had become Roman Catholic the other day, and he was laughing about how when he was in the Protestant seminary, he remembered how he thought his faith was supported by the fathers of the church. Because when he was in seminary, in the Protestant seminary, the Protestant professor would quote from St. John Chrysostom, from St. Augustine, from St. Jerome, Gregory the Great, Irenaeus, Justin Martyr, Ignatius of Antioch. And so he thought, well, there it is. It's all there. I've got it. It's all in his notes. Then he picked up a real text of the fathers of the church and started reading for himself. And he found out that there were all these ellipses in the quotes that were given to him in the seminary. And the ellipses, the sections that had been deleted in these lectures at the seminary, were all of the, of course, texts that would make all of them very uncomfortable in a Protestant seminary. Right? So, context, context, context. You got to read the whole thing. Got to read, what does the text really say? Right? So let's first begin right there at verse 4, and then we'll spiral out from there. Let's look at verse 4. What does verse 4 actually say? It says, you shall not make for yourself a what? A what? The text I'm reading to you here so far is the RSV Catholic edition. This is graven image in this text here. Graven image. Does anyone else have anything else? I see a New American Bible over there. I'll bet you have something else. What do you have there?
It says, you shall not have idols for your hands.
The New American Bible is one of the few texts today that has properly translated this.
At least that.
At least that. That's one of the few places. So Anna's Bible said, you shall not make an idol. Now, why does her Bible say that? I hate it when they change the Bible. Well, no, they're not changing the Bible. They're properly translating, particularly in this case. What does the word say there in the Hebrew? What does the word graven image mean? Graven image, graven. You ever use the word graven in modern English? Happen to be at the grocery store and you ask if there's any graven images on aisle 5 or anything? No, because graven's not a modern English word. We don't even use the word anymore. It's an old English word. Our translations, this is the problem with translation, right? They're always archaic. No one ever wants to change anything. So, you know, you memorized it. My grandmother memorized it and you keep going. Well, what does it mean? I don't care, but at least I have it memorized. Well, you got to know what it means, right? So every now and then, every few generations, you got to update the translation because English is a living language. So, graven, old English, graven, graven means carved, something that is carved. In fact, the modern English word carved, that's just a C-G interchange. Grav, krav, right? In fact, this goes back to an Indo-European root, graf, graf. You probably know grafo, like in Greek, to write. G-R-A-P-H. You've probably seen that, grafo, grafo. So this is an Indo-European root to carve. And in the old world, you didn't write with ink, you carved into things, right, when you wrote things. So graven, carved. In fact, our word grave comes from that, something you dig out of the earth. Okay, so graven, a graven image, a carved image. What about your statue you might have? Go down the street, down to the Roman Catholic Church down the street, you might see a statue of the Virgin Mary out in front. Isn't that a graven image, a carved image? probably poured concrete, but originally, you get the idea. So carved, right? Carved image. Carved image. But is that what the text says? Look what it says here. It says, grave an image. But you have over there, Anna's got her New American Bible, idol. Do you know why it's there? Because that's what it actually says. In the Hebrew text, the Hebrew word here is pesel, P-E-S-E-L in English. Pesel, P-E-S-E-L. Pesel. Now, what does pesel mean in Hebrew? Well, pesel means image. Okay? Image. So you can get rid of the word graven, carved. Right? You can eliminate that. Just image. Okay? That's a much more simple translation of it. But when you translate from one language to another, you don't just simply translate. You find a word that kind of is similar or has a basic same idea and translate. You've got to understand the context of how these words are used dynamically. So pesel, the root in Hebrew, does just mean image, yes. However, if you look at the word pesel, or peselim, plural, all over the Hebrew Bible, it's used in only one way. And there's a lot of occurrences of it. It is always used in every single occurrence as a reference to a pagan religious image that the Israelites are being commanded to destroy. A pagan religious image. Well, what do we call a pagan religious image? Well, what's a pagan religious image? It's an image of a pagan god. That's called an idol, right? We call that an idol. Guess what? This is also how the Jews translated the text in what's called the Septuagint. When you translate the Hebrew into Greek 200 years before Christ, the Jews translate from the Hebrew into the Greek. These are Jews doing this 200 years before Christ. They translate the word pesel in the way that it was understood by them. Not simply as image or carved image, but as an idol. In the Greek text, you have the word idolon. Idolon, which is the Greek word from which we get our transliteration in English, idol. Idolon. Idol. And the on ending is just the neuter ending. So this is that root. It's the same word. Okay? That's how they understood it. It was an idol. It was an idol. Now, that's how Luther also understood it. This is how traditionally it's been understood. But this is not how Calvin read it. He said, well, it's a religious image. Well, let's circle around in the context a bit and see if we can get a little more confirmation of one reading or the other. Look what it says up in verse 1. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am Yahweh your God. See all caps there for Lord, that's the divine name. I am Yahweh, your personal God. Yahweh. Not Baal or Apis or one of the other pagan gods or Molech. I am Yahweh, your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. In the previous chapters, you heard about the Exodus story, right? Out of that house of bondage. Verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. So what's going on there in verses 1 and 2 and 3? Well, monotheism versus polytheism. Are you going to worship the one true God that brought you out of Egypt, the God Yahweh, the God of Abraham, or are you going to worship many gods? Remember, in Egypt, they were polytheists, and the Israelites, by the way, were polytheists in Egypt too. We're going to see shortly with the golden calf story when they revert to it. So when God brings the Israelites out of Egypt, he's not bringing them out of Egypt to give them some sort of political freedom. It's not a liberation theology, although that's how the Ten Commandments, you know, Hollywood version portrays it, as it tries to get American support for the state of Israel at that time. But the Ten Commandments movie is missing the point. The book of the Exodus is all about spiritual freedom. You never hear Moses say, let my people go, as you get in the Hollywood version. It's, let my people go that they may serve me, that they may serve Yahweh, that they may sacrifice to me and not to you, Pharaoh, and your gods. That's what it's all about. So look at this, these first lines here. I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. It's me, me alone, no one else. Right? Then you come to verse 4. You shall not make for yourself an image of one of these pagan gods, an idol, or of any likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or in the earth beneath, or in the waters beneath the earth. You shall not bow down and worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. You see how that works? So the line following verse 4 is also about monotheism versus polytheism. Worship me and not them. Right? The lines before verse 4, monotheism versus polytheism. So I wonder what the verse in the middle is all about. Monotheism versus polytheism, possibly? But look at the historical context. So there's the literary context, the immediate literary context. What about the historical context? We already talked about that. The people of Israel had been in Egypt for 400 years. They were eating like Egyptians, dressing like Egyptians, talking like Egyptians, walking like Egyptians, and worshiping like Egyptians. You have any doubt about that? Wait till we get to the golden calf. Right? So, historical context, monotheism versus polytheism. It's the basic theme of the Pentateuch. Worship only Yahweh and not these other pagan gods. The immediate context, literary context, monotheism versus polytheism. The way the Jews translated the text from Hebrew into Greek with the word idol and the very word pestle in the Hebrew being used universally in the Hebrew text in reference to idolatry. It's pretty clear. But it actually gets quite funny in a few chapters. Let's turn to chapter 25 and see if we can find an umpire for the debate. Exodus chapter 25. Now this is just a few chapters later. Exodus chapter 25. The Lord said to Moses, so he's come down the mountain with the Ten Commandments, remember? And they said, all that the Lord has said we will do. This is chapter 24. And then they splash the blood on the altar and splash the blood on the people. You remember this? They have a meal. They make a covenant. And then because they've made a covenant, they've agreed to the Ten Commandments, Moses goes back up the mountain and he gets the blueprints for the place where God will dwell among his people because they've agreed to abide by his rules. Remember those Ten Commandments. While he's up on the mountain, of course, the people down below start doing something else. But look what he hears up on the mountain. Chapter 25, the Lord said to Moses, he's up on the mountain, this is just God and Moses talking, speak to the people of Israel, when you get down, that they take from me an offering from every man whose heart is willing. Free will offering from all this beautiful stuff you might have. Where'd they get all this beautiful stuff? Fine twine linen, gold, silver, jewels. From the Egyptians. Remember, God caused the Egyptians to give them their wealth as they walked out the door. Remember that. What is the purpose of all of this beautiful stuff that they're going to willingly give to Moses to do something with? What is it? Look at verse 8. Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst. The purpose of the tabernacle is that God may dwell among them in an earthly tent like they are. This is what the prologue is all about, right, of John's gospel. And he became flesh and dwelt among us. A Greek word there, to dwell among us, to pitch a tent. So it says in verse 10, then we get the directions for how to make the Ark of the Covenant. He starts with the most important sacred piece of furniture in the tabernacle. That's the Ark of the Covenant. It's a big box about the size of, a big bathtub. Okay? Made out of acacia wood. Why acacia wood? Because that's all that's out there, scrub trees. And then they cover it on the inside and the outside with gold. Why? What's the purpose of this box? Look what it says in verse. My eyes are going here. Verse 16. It says, put the testimony there. Put the testimony in there. That's the Ten Commandments. Everyone knows that. The Ten Commandments went inside the box, right? And then it says, put a lid on the box. Look at verse 17. It's called a mercy seat. A mercy seat. Why a seat? Because God's going to sit on it. This is God's throne. The glory cloud is going to rest right there on top of the box. Well, not exactly on the box. And this is the point now that we're looking at here. There are two cherubim with their wings outspread. Wings outspread. The wings, the tips are touching in the middle. And God's glory cloud is going to rest on the wings of these golden cherubim, these graven images. Right? Carved images of pure gold on top of the box that holds the commandment that says you can't have graven images. Maybe a mistranslation, possibly. Either that or you got a schizophrenic God. Right? So he says one thing one place, and here he says something else. Obviously not. Right? Obviously God is immutable. He always says the same thing. He does not change. And so there's no possible way to read Exodus chapter 20, verse 4 as a condemnation of the making of a religious carved image, because Moses is commanded by God in this most sacred text of how to build the most sacred part of the tabernacle, for God to literally sit on two graven images, two carved images. I remember listening to a Protestant minister one time on the radio, and he happened to be talking about the tabernacle. And I was listening, and he's talking about Exodus 24 and then Exodus chapter 25. Wow. He's going to talk about Exodus 25. I thought they tried to avoid that text. And he starts talking about the box, the acacia wood box, and it's lined with gold. He's going into detail. I'm turning the radio up. What's he going to do? So then he says, and then on top of the box, there was this lid, and God rested on the lid. There were these angels there. Okay, well, anyway, let's keep going. How's he going to talk about it, right? So, they were statues. They were carved images. If there's anything that was a graven image, it's this, right? A carved image. And Moses made them, or at least was commanded by God to make them. Now, God rests on this. And look what it says. What does it say about this place where this is going to happen? Verse 22. There I will meet with you. And from above the mercy seat, from between the two carved images of cherubim that are upon the Ark of Testimony, I will speak with you of all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel. As you read through the rest of the description of the tabernacle that's made, the place is covered with images. Look at chapter 26, verse 1. Cherubim embroidered all over the curtains, the goatskin curtains and everything. It's got cherubim everywhere. The place is covered with images of cherubim. Now get out of your head, overweight little baby things with wings on their back. Now that's Cupid. That's a pagan image that was picked up during the Renaissance period when there was an interest in old Greco-Roman pagan artwork, and it made its way tragically during the Renaissance period into Western artwork. But if you go before the Renaissance period and look at images of cherubim, east and west, you're not going to find an overweight little baby Cupid thing. Okay? That's a pagan god. Now, as you read to the end of the book of Exodus, you find that they eventually make the tabernacle. And what does it say in chapter 40? Look at chapter 40. Did God approve of all of this? Of course he did. He had said in every single episode, make it according to the pattern I show you on the mountain. This isn't Moses' Egyptian design. This isn't some influence from Egyptian temple work. This is according to the pattern that God showed him on the mountain. He made an image of God's cherubic throne, which you actually get another vision of in Ezekiel. Remember Ezekiel with the angels, the cherubim, the wheels, and all that? Okay. Chapter 40, look what happens, verse 34. Chapter 40 to verse 34, God's glory cloud descends and fills the tabernacle, showing his approval. He likes the place. He rests on the wings of these graven images. Now, You know the rest of the story of the Old Testament. Eventually, the people of Israel leave Mount Sinai. They head into the Promised Land. They eventually build the temple. Remember, Solomon builds that temple. According to the pattern that God showed David, by the way. They built the temple according to the same structure and layout, basically, of what the sanctuary that Moses made. Let's look at a quick example of that. 1 Kings, chapter 6. 1 Kings, chapter 6. Verse 11. You can see the purpose of this temple is the very same purpose of Moses' sanctuary. It's just simply a permanent, really heavy version of what came before. Right before, it was acacia wood and goatskin, so they could travel with it. Now they have a permanent location. So now you have to have a permanent temple out of stone. So look what it says, chapter 6, verse 11. Now the word of the Lord came to Solomon concerning this house which you are building. If you will walk in my statutes and obey my ordinances and keep all my commandments, including Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, and walk in them, then I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to David your father. And I will dwell among the children of Israel, and I will not forsake my people Israel. So if you keep my commandments, I'm going to fulfill my promise to David. That is that his descendants shall maintain the throne in Jerusalem, and you're going to be part of that line. If you keep my commandments. He says, and I will dwell among them. Remember chapter 20, verse 8 of the Exodus, right? Purpose is to dwell among his people. Many people think of the tabernacle that Moses made, the temple, as a place to sacrifice. That was not the purpose. The purpose is it was a house, a place where God would dwell among his people. This is extremely important for understanding the incarnation and why John in the prologue talks about the incarnation in the way he does. Okay. So then, as you read the rest of the description of going to the temple, guess what you find? Graven images everywhere. It starts in verse 23. Look at verse 23. Actually, back in verse 18 even, you get a reference to open flowers and gourds. Back in chapter 6, verse 18, open flowers and gourds. Why flowers? Why gourds? What's in a gourd? You ever eaten one? No. Not good for eating. Why? Because they're filled with seeds. What's the association of a flower and a gourd? We'll see in a second. Now, you get some real serious graven images in verse 23. Look at verse 23. It says, in the inner sanctuary he made two cherubim. This is 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 23. In the inner sanctuary he made two cherubim. These are not overweight little babies. Of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. 5 cubits was the length of one wing. A cubit's a foot and a half. Okay? These are big. 15-foot statues. They're made out of wood, olive wood. They're not in the desert anymore, so they don't need acacia wood. So these olive wood, much nicer, stronger. And they also, and then they cover it in gold. And on each side of the Holy of Holies, in the Holy of Holies, were these. There was this cherubim on each side, a cherub on each side, with its wings outspread. One wing touching the wall, the other wing touching the tip of the other cherub. On the other side, the same thing. One wing touching the tip in the middle, and the other one touching the wall. And underneath the wings touching together was the ark. Everything in the temple Solomon makes is multiplied either in number or in size of what Moses had done. Moses had a pool for washing the hands and feet for the priests. Solomon makes a doughboy pool, 10,000 gallons. So everything is bigger in size and number in Solomon's temple, but it's all the same model, the same idea. Okay, so 15-foot statues in the Holy of Holies, where the ark is going to be, that has the Ten Commandments, including Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, you shall have no graven images. As you read throughout the rest of the building of the temple, look at the description here. Verse 29, he carved all the walls of the house round about with carved figures of cherubim, palm trees, open flowers. Verse 32, palm trees, open flowers. Verse 35, palm trees, open flowers. Why flowers? Why palm trees? Why gourds? Goes on. Chapter 7, verse 20. The place is decorated with chains, golden chains with huge golden pomegranates hanging. What's a pomegranate got in it? Seeds. All right, you can hear the fertility imagery here. Flowers, gourds, pomegranates. Look at, you see, you have more flowers, lily work in verse 22, gourds in verse 24, and I love this one. Look at verse 25. That big doughboy pool. Moses had that, you know, maybe a 10-gallon bucket, basically, to wash hands and feet in. Solomon makes a 10,000-gallon pool, and it rests on the backs of life-size, if not larger-than-life, oxen. Wait a minute. What about the golden calf? Yeah. What about the golden calf? What's the difference? Huge. Here we have 12 life-size oxen holding up the bowl of washing, the bowl of purity, which represents the 12 tribes of Israel. There we have just a little calf. Just a tiny little calf. What's the difference? Big, as we're going to see. Big difference. It goes on. Look at the more details. It says in verse 28. In verse 28, lions, oxen, cherubim carved on the walls. Again, look at verse 36. Cherubim, lions, palm trees. Lions, tigers, and bears. Oh my. Kidding about the bears part. Okay, so the place is covered in images. Why animals? Why palm trees? It's the Garden of Eden reestablished. God and man are dwelling together right here. That's why you get Edenic life imagery. We could go on and on. The place is filled with graven images, carved religious imagery. Carved religious imagery. Okay? Now, do you think God liked it? No, he showed up and said, get rid of all this stuff. Paint all the walls white. No. It says in chapter 8, verse 6, they brought the ark under the wings of the cherubim. Remember those 15-footers? And then it says the glory cloud, verse 10 and 11, the glory cloud filled the temple, showing that God liked the place. This is how God commanded for his places to be built where he's going to dwell among man in the Old Testament. You think God had a problem with graven images? I remember reading a Jack Chick article on this. Jack Chick is really poorly researched Protestant apologetic works. And he says over and over how much God hates graven images. And it's so funny to read that. Because all you have to do is look at all these images here. These are graven images. But Exodus chapter 20, verse 4 doesn't say graven images. How funny. So then, what is being condemned in Exodus chapter 20, verse 4? The making of artwork? Surely not. The making of religious artwork? Surely not. The making of idols? I wonder. Now, let's go look at two texts that clearly refer to this issue. Exodus chapter 32. Exodus chapter 32. Exodus chapter 32. In the very same book, just a few chapters later, when Moses is up there getting the directions of how to make the tabernacle where God's going to dwell among his people, built from the gold and jewels that God caused the Egyptians to give to the Israelites, they took that gold and did something tragic with it. Exodus chapter 32. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down the mountain. Now, why is he delayed? He's up there getting all these details on how to build a place where God's going to dwell among them. The people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said, "Get up, make us a god who shall go for us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Why would they do such a thing? Well, they're in the tip of the Sinai Peninsula. Okay, it's probably 120 degrees. There's not a lot of food or water. Right? They have the spring that Moses had hit with, you know, when he hit the rock. But it's not a great place to live. Today, there's not a whole lot out there. There's some monks, right? St. Catherine's. There's a monastery out there. That's a place where monks will dwell out in the desert. But there's not a nice city out there or anything, right? It's hot, dry, desolate. So they're out there, and there's nothing out there. They don't know where to go. They don't even know where they are. They don't have GPS. They don't have a map of the place. Everywhere they look is simply desert. And so they say, "Get up, make us a god that may go before us, to lead us," right? So verse 2, Aaron said to them, "Take off the rings of gold which are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters and bring them to me." So they take all the gold, these gold rings they got from the Egyptians, right, on the way out the door. So all the people took all the rings of gold which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron, and he received the gold at their hand and fashioned with it, with a graving tool, a carving tool, and made a molten calf. And they said, the people said when they saw it, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." What? I don't think that's what brought them up. Now, why did he make a calf? Well, this was the favorite god of the Israelites in Egypt. This is the god Apis. The Egyptians, of course, worshipped many gods. One of their gods, among many, was the god Apis. He was a fertility god, worshipped in the form of a bull calf, right? A very fertile animal, right? The bull calf. When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh." They didn't want to listen. And they rose up the next morning and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Now, I already told you about the problems of the Hollywood movie, The Ten Commandments. This is one of the places where they do a pretty nice job of representing what's going on. They have a calf built out of wood, and they cover it in gold, and then you see the festivities of what they're doing. I don't have to get into details about what they did in a fertility cult. So verse 7, "And the Lord said to Moses, go down to your people." My people? Wait a minute. That's not what you said before. Yeah, your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt. What's happened? They're no longer God's people. They've broken covenant. How did they break covenant? It says, "They have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them." Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. "They have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." Uh-oh. Big problem. Is that possibly a direct contradiction of Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 5? Yeah. And of course, the author of the text here is hoping you're going to hear the echoes, right? He writes it so you hear exactly the echoes. So they're in big trouble, right? Moses goes down there and destroys the thing. The god Apis. If you never heard of this before, make a note for yourself in your Bibles. Jeremiah chapter 46, verses 13 through 17. Jeremiah chapter 46, verses 13 through 17. You get another reference there in Jeremiah to the god Apis, because the Israelites during the time of Jeremiah are going to flee from the Babylonians. Some of them are going to flee down to Egypt. So he condemns there for a number of reasons, that Apis cult that he knows the Israelites have a proclivity toward. Okay. Another example of pagan idolatry in the Bible, Daniel chapter 3. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. You probably know the story well. This is one of the favorites in children's Bibles and things like that. Also in our Eastern tradition, we always have an icon of this story in the baptistry. This is the burning or the attempt to burn the three friends of Daniel, right? Look at what it says in chapter 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits, its breadth 6 cubits. Huge statue. Remember, cubits a foot and a half. Why does he make a statue of all gold? You have to read the story before. Remember in chapter 2, he was told about a big image he had in his dream of different types of metals that represented different successive empires, right? So Nebuchadnezzar is trying to steer history in his own way by making a huge statue, an image from his dream, all of gold, not just the head of gold. And he says, everyone must fall down and worship this god I have made, this god of Babylon. Verse 4, and the herald proclaimed aloud, you, O commander, O peoples, nations, and languages, when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, the organ, the guitars, whatever, the tambourines, fall down and worship. Look what it says. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be thrown into the fiery furnace. So they started playing all the instruments. This is one of the reasons among many why in our Byzantine tradition we do not have musical instruments in our church. When they played all the musical instruments, it says they all fell down, verse 7, and worshipped. Then, verse 8 and following, we hear about the three friends of Daniel who refused to fall down and worship. Look what it says in verse 11. Whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the furnace. Don't you know that? It says in verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province. These are guys who report the problem to Nebuchadnezzar. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no heed to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. They refuse to worship the gods of Babylon, including this one. Notice the problem here is not the making of a golden image. Remember the two statues, the golden statues on top of the ark? The problem is the nature of the image and the purpose of the image. This is a pagan god that Nebuchadnezzar is intending to be worshipped. In fact, it says when Nebuchadnezzar hears about this, it says, verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar says, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you will not serve my gods or worship the golden image which I have set up? This is called Hebrew synonymous parallelism, same thing. Said twice. He says, if you will not fall down and worship, verse 15, then you will be cast in the fiery furnace. Verse 16, they say, we will not, O Nebuchadnezzar, we will not. We have no need to answer you in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, whatever happens, whatever God does with us, know this, we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up. Again, synonymous parallelism. We will not worship and serve the golden image of the God you have set up. That's how synonymous parallelism works. You know the rest of the story, of course. We don't need to read it all. What's going on here? This is the Israelites are being forced to worship pagan gods of Babylon. What were they tempted to do at the golden calf? To worship a pagan god of Egypt. What was being condemned in both places? What's the problem? Pagan idolatry, right? Polytheism versus monotheism. Worship of the one true God versus the false gods. And when you worship the false gods in the ancient world, you always made images of them. But it's not the making of the image. It's not the creation of an image of artwork in general or religious, but rather artwork of an image, a portrayal of a pagan god, so that you can focus on that thing and worship it. Synonymous, or polytheism and idolatry, paganism, this is all one package in the ancient world. All one package. Okay? So, this is why, as I mentioned to you before we started, in the Protestant Reformation, we have, unfortunately, in Calvin, an iconoclast. I mean, a image smasher, right? They went through and they destroyed the images of the churches that they took over. Well, this was not the first time it had happened in the history of the church. Unfortunately, due to Islam, which is also an iconoclastic religion, which has misread the Old Testament and created the Quran, they also are iconoclastic, and so unfortunately, iconoclasm actually crept up in the 8th century. In the 8th century, the 7th and 8th century, in the East, there was a brief period of iconoclasm. This is why we actually don't have a whole lot of beautiful ancient artwork from the early church. A lot of it was just destroyed at that period due to Islamic influence on Christianity during that period. This was a heresy. Heresy. The church condemned this heresy of iconoclasm in the 7th Ecumenical Council. In the 7th Ecumenical Council, let me read to you the key text. This is in 787, the 7th Ecumenical Council. We therefore define with all certitude and accuracy that just as the figure of the precious and life-giving cross, so also the venerable and holy images, as well in paintings and mosaics as other fit materials, should be set forth in the holy churches of God, and on the sacred vessels, and on the vestments, and on the hangings, and in the pictures, both in houses and by the wayside. To wit, the figure of our Lord, God, and Savior Jesus Christ, our spotless Lady, the Mother of God, of the honorable angels, of all the saints, and all the pious people, for by so much more frequently as they are seen in artistic representation, by so much more readily are men lifted up to the memory of their prototypes, to their reality, right? And to a longing after them. And to these should be given due salutation, honorable reverence, not indeed that true worship of faith which pertains alone to the divine nature, but according to ancient pious custom. So, what is it saying here? It says that the churches should be filled, and the street corners and the homes, with beautiful images of our Lord, of the Mother of God, and of all the saints. Because when men's eyes perceive these things, like Moses walking into the Holy of Holies, their eyes are lifted up, their minds are lifted up to the reality that they cannot see with their physical eyes. The purpose of religious imagery in the churches is to remind us, to assist us in our prayer, of the things that we cannot see with our physical eyes. The story of salvation history. How do you see salvation history? Only if it's portrayed in images. By the way, this is not an invention of Christianity. As we already saw in the Old Testament, this is what we found in the sanctuary that Moses built. This is what we found in the temple. And guess what? As they've dug up synagogues from the first century and onward, they have found that the walls are covered with icons, murals of the crossing of the Red Sea, of the reception of the tablets up on Mount Sinai. Just like you find in the early churches, mural on the walls, mosaic on the walls with beautiful stories of salvation history and the saints of the old covenant. So likewise, in the churches, you see the exact same thing from that same tradition. Judaism is not iconoclastic. Go visit a synagogue down the street. They have no problem with images. Stained glass windows, all sorts of stuff. Statuary. As long as it lifts up men's minds to the things they cannot see with their physical eyes. Right? That's the purpose of the religious imagery and the teachings of the Seventh Ecumenical Council.